they take you up, like,
all the way
to the, yeah, through, oh, well, to the wherever that tunnel is, and they have like special access. So.
Mm-hmm. Very nice. Do they have it with musical instruments? There are some places they have.
Believe not.
No, they don't have musical instruments right now.
Not that I know. Mm-hmm. That'd be pretty amazing.
Yeah, some places have.
Where?
Now I know a women's Rosh Chodesh group. And to get together to say hello, we actually have a harp and a violin.
Wow,
full on ensemble.
Yeah. So anyway, I just want to go over a little bit that, you know, Sefer Shemos, as we've said a number of times, has three ideas, Yetzias Mitzrayim and Matan Torah. And now we come to the third part of Shemos, which is Hakamas HaMishkan. And the first thing to know is there's a big, big machlokas. Once again, I mentioned last week that with respect to the sequence of events at Matan Torah, there's a big argument between Rashi and the Ramban about the events at the end of Parshas Mishpatim. That Rashi says, this is an example of Ein Muktim U'Mukhar B'Torah. The Torah does not follow chronological order. And the whole idea of the Mizbeach and the Nasa V'Nishma, that occurred before. Right? Rashi moves that. Well, Rashi does an even more radical Ein Muktim U'Mukhar B'Torah here. If Rashi takes the events at the end of Parshas Mishpatim and moves them earlier, then here Rashi takes Mishkan and moves it later. And I think we discussed it earlier in the week, the Machlokas Rashi and Ramban, was Mishkan a response to the Chet HaEgel, or was Mishkan something that would have pre-existed the Chet HaEgel? Rashi Shita is, again, had there not been a Chet HaEgel, there wouldn't have been a Mishkan. Be it as it may, let's ask a simple question. The Pasuk says, V'yasu li mikdash, make for me a mikdash, and I will dwell in their midst. This is one of the 613 mitzvahs in the Torah. There's a mitzvah that is called building a sanctuary to Hashem. That's a mitzvah. In the Midbar was the Mishkan, in Yerushalayim it's the Beis HaMikdash. So the question becomes, why don't we do that today? Why don't we build a Beis HaMikdash today? Now you could argue, well, it's dangerous because nefesh, etc. But is there a more basic reason? Like, what is the, if there is one, what is the exemption that we have b'zman hazeh from building the Beis HaMikdash? So there is a bit of a question. It's very clear that the Rambam says lahalacha lemaisa that it is Mashiach that's going to build the Bayis Shlishi, and we don't build it until Mashiach comes. That's what the Rambam says. Rashi in Masechet Shavuos says something even more radical. Rashi in Masechet Shavuos says that the third Beis HaMikdash is not built by people at all. The third Beis HaMikdash is Yored Min HaShemayim. So whether we say like Rashi that it's Yored Min HaShemayim, or whether we say like the Rambam that Mashiach is going to be, it's clear that both of them take the position that there's no chiyuv on us to build the Beis HaMikdash. Now the question is, why should that be so? I mean, we normally don't say, I mean, if there's a mitzvah in the Torah, we normally don't take the position that we're not supposed to do that mitzvah until Mashiach comes. What would the halachic basis be that would exempt us from building the Beis HaMikdash? So there's an interesting Chassam Sefer that offers an explanation and a comment in Rashi. In the Pasuk says in the beginning of Truma, Kachayel Asher Ani Mareuscha, in accordance with everything that I show you, the shape of the Mishkan and the Kalim, Kain Ta'asu, so shall you do. So Rashi says two words, or one word, Lidoros, that the same way the Mishkan was constructed, so too the Beis HaMikdash will be constructed the same way. The Ramban asks that Rashi makes no sense, because it's absolutely clear that the construction details of the Beis HaMikdash in no way parallel the Mishkan. The Beis HaMikdash was bigger, the Mizbeach was a different size. Now, how could Rashi make the point that the same way it was in the Mishkan, so it must be Lidoros? That's not emes. So the Chassam Sefer is Masbir Rashi in a very amazing way.
I'm sorry, what's Masbir?
Explains. Explains Rashi in a very amazing way. When Rashi says all future temples have to be modeled on the Mishkan, Rashi doesn't mean in terms of size and in terms of dimension. It's a davar pashut that the size and the dimension were different. But it means that just as the Mishkan could only be built when there was specific prophetic revelation as to how and when it should be constructed, so too every future Beis HaMikdash can only be constructed by direct prophetic revelation. In contradistinction to the general Torah, in which we say prophecy has very little role, lo v'shamayim, the Torah is not in heaven. A prophet is not even supposed to tell you the halachas left. If we have a machlokas, and some Navi comes in with a miracle and says, Hashem said the halachas like this Monday Omer, we don't listen to that. Binyan Beis HaMikdash is an exception, because the mitzvah itself is defined as being the product of direct divine revelation. And this is the makor of the Rambam's idea that only Mashiach can build the Beis HaMikdash, because once again it requires the restoration of prophecy, and prophecy is not going to be restored until we have Mashiach. Right? Eliyahu HaNavi is going to restore prophecy. This is the halachic basis of the idea that Bizman HaZeh, it is not our mitzvah to build a Beis HaMikdash. Now, last time I discussed a related question, but don't confuse it. I discussed the issue of why can't we bring korbanos today. But these are two different questions. Because technically, even without a Beis HaMikdash, we're allowed to bring korbanos according to the Rambam, because the holiness of the Temple Mount never lapsed. So I mentioned Rabbi Kiva Eiger, that the reason why we don't bring korbanos today is we are mesupik in halacha. Do we paskin like the Rambam or the Ravid? The Rambam says the Har HaBayis has Kedusha today. The Ravid says after the Churban, the Har HaBayis does not have Kedusha today. Now, the Ravid would have a leniency. According to the Ravid, we would be allowed to walk on the Temple Mount, even though we're Tameh, doesn't have Kedusha. The Ravid would allow that. But the Ravid wouldn't allow Korbanos, because since Korbanos can only be brought on the site of the Mikdash, it no longer has that holiness. The Rambam is exactly in reverse. The Rambam would prohibit us from walking on the Har HaBayis when we're Tameh, but he would permit the offering of Korbanos because that Makam has Kedusha. And for the Korban Seber, we would be allowed to go in when we're Tameh, because Tuma is permitted for communal offerings. So Rabbi Kivager's argument is that because there's a halachic uncertainty, if the halacha is like the Rambam or the Ravid, we have to err on the side of being strict on both sides of the equation. We don't enter the Har HaBayis for a tiyul, because maybe the halacha is like the Rambam, that the makam is holy and I'm tameh. However, we don't bring korbanos on the Har HaBayis, because maybe the halacha is like the Ravid and the makam has no kedusha. But as I say, that's a separate question about banos. But that itself would not be an answer why we don't build a Beis HaMikdash. The short answer to that is, once again, that even if we would be tahor, even if we would be ritually tahor, we would not build a Beis HaMikdash, because you need a direct prophetic revelation, and that is the meaning of V'chein Tasu, just as the Mishkan was built only with a direct command by God, so too the Beis HaMikdash requires that trigger every single iteration of the Beis HaMikdash. By the way, though, it is interesting. I mean, I think empirically I could ask a question on this, because all of us know the first Beis HaMikdash, of course, was built when Hashem commanded David HaMelech to gather things to build a Mikdash. David could not build it himself, and then Hashem commanded through Nathan the prophet, Nathan the Navi, that Shlomo should build it. Similarly, the second Beis HaMikdash, after the 70 years of the Babylonian exile, there was direct prophetic revelation to Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi, the last prophets. Okay, and now, but here's the thing that I think is a little historically problematical. We know that the second Beis HaMikdash, of course, was destroyed by the Romans in the year 70. Now, in around the year 135, around 65 years later, there was a great, great Jewish uprising against the Romans, and this was the uprising which was led by Bar Kokhba. And Rabbi Akiva believed Bar Kokhba was Mashiach. In fact, that's why he gave him the name Bar Kokhba. Shimon Ben Kuziva's name was Ben Kuziva. Rabbi Akiva called him Bar Kokhba, which means son of a star, because Mashiach is described as a Kocha. And Rabbi Akiva was actively involved in supporting Bar Kochba, although Rabbi Akiva was very old at the time. And another Tana told Rabbi Akiva, Akiva, grass is going to grow out of your hands before Mashiach comes. Don't get involved in this. And what happened was that the Bar Kochba revolt initially was very successful. Bar Kochba liberated, so to speak, 900 towns and villages from Roman rule. He established a Jewish independent state of Rome in a lot of areas of Israel. But what eventually happened was Hadrian ruthlessly crushed this revolt, and that's what happened at Beta, which also was on Tisha B'Av. It was 65 years later on Tisha B'Av. And the Gemara itself indicates that the number of Jews that were massacred at Beta was much, much greater than that died at the Korban. And in fact, although losing the Beis HaMikdash is an irreplaceable loss, but in point of fact, in many, many ways, the aftermath of Beit HaMikdash was much worse than the aftermath of the Korban. Because the Romans destroyed the temple, but Jews were still allowed to live in Yerushalayim, they were allowed to learn Torah, they were allowed to do mitzvahs. All of the anti-Torah decrees that the Gemara describes about the Romans, can't learn Torah, and if you learn Torah, they'll kill you. That was not in the aftermath of the Chorban. That was in the aftermath of the fall of Beitar in the year 135. Jews were banished from Yerushalayim, etc. But the reason I'm bringing this up is that there is some archaeological evidence that in Bar Kochba's time, they actually began, with Rabbi Akiva's supervision, they actually began making a foundation for the third Beis HaMikdash. Amazingly enough, it got aborted when the Bar Kochba revolt failed. That's how archaeologists have tried to reconcile different issues. There are certain inconsistencies where things are and we're not sure. The first Beis HaMikdash, we have actually no archaeological trace. It's very, very strange. So we have nothing from the first Beis HaMikdash. That's totally gone. We do have things from the second Beis HaMikdash, but there seems to be an inconsistency where certain things were located, and it is posited that some of the inconsistencies stem from a beginning of an aborted Beis HaMikdash that was not completed, which of course is very consistent with Rabbi Akiva, considering Bar Kochba and Mashiach. On the other hand, I think we have to ask, where was the prophet? Where was the prophecy? Was there a false prophet that Rabbi Akiva was taken in by? We don't know exactly. Did Rabbi Akiva believe Bar Kochba was a Mashiach even though there was no Eliyahu Navi or there was no Nevuah? How did Rabbi Akiva understand the coming of Mashiach? I mean, we seem to understand it, like the Rambam says, Eliyahu Navi is going to come and announce, right? But he didn't have that in Bar Kochba's case, so apparently it's not necessary. In other words, I'm just asking, if according to the Chasam Sofer, Binyan Beis HaMikdash requires direct Nevuah, then I think we would be hard-pressed to explain how Rabbi Akiva could have authorized the building of a third Beis HaMikdash. And the archaeologists at least say that he did. Now again, I'm not aware of any statement in Chazal that says he did it. So we don't really know. Maybe Chazal maintained he didn't do it, or maybe Chazal didn't want to mention it because they didn't want to encourage other people to try to build a Beis HaMikdash. Now, there's another story here. So that was the beginning of a third temple. The beginning of a third temple. Now, around 200 years later, around the 300s, way after the Tanaim, this is already the time of Amorayim, there was an interesting thing. You know, Rome had converted to Christianity from paganism during the reign of Constantine. Constantine was the guy that converted, although he remained a pagan until the day that he died, whatever. He did this for political reasons. There were so many Christians, etc., that he thought would be kedai to make Christianity the state religion. Now, unfortunately, the Christians who had been persecuted under pagan Rome became persecutors. They didn't develop rachamim from their experience, and there was vicious anti-Semitism from that time. But after a bunch of Christian emperors following Constantine, there was a fellow named Julian. And Julian didn't like Christianity. Julian is known in Christian history as Julian the Apostate, because Julian wanted to go back to the old Avodah Zarah of Rome. Now this sounds very funny, But paradoxically, the old Avodah Zorah of Rome, certainly the pre-Bar Kokhba Avodah Zorah of Rome, was actually much more tolerant to Judaism than was Christianity. For the following reason. Monotheistic religions have to be less tolerant, because if you believe there's only one God, then if you have another belief, you know, you're an idol worshiper. If I'm a pagan, as bad as Avodah Zorah is, a pagan can afford to be tolerant, because, hey, there's 100 gods, okay, you have 101. So Julian the Apostate didn't like Christians, but he liked Jews. So Julian the Apostate actually gave the Jews permission to begin building the third Beis HaMikdash. Right? He actually gave them permission. And once again, it is recorded that they began to do so. Again, where was your prophet? And who were the rabbis? That's right. I'm not aware of any rabbis that even were involved in this process.
That's what it failed.
Well, what happened was there was a massive, massive earthquake on the Temple Mount. So whatever was done there got utterly, utterly wiped out. Obviously, there the answer is very clear. HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells you that it's not time yet for the Beis HaMikdash. But Julian the Apostate actually allowed it. I believe he was killed. I believe he was assassinated. You know, so he didn't have a long reign because he was bucking the political trends in the Roman Empire. But these two examples, the abortive Beis HaMikdash in Bar Kokhba's time and the beginning of a building in Julian the Apostate's time, 200 years later, seem to contradict the Chasam Sofer's halachic assumption that you need direct nevuah. Unless you're going to say that, well, the Bar Kokhba thing is a problem because Rabbi Akiva was involved, but Julian the Apostate, maybe nobody, no halachic authorities were involved, and people just did it. But again, you do have to remember that the halachic analysis of not bringing korbanos and the halachic analysis of building the Beis HaMikdash, these are two different halachic issues. We don't build the temple, the Chasam Sofer says, because we don't have a prophetic revelation to that effect. We don't bring korbanos, Rabbi Kivager says, because we're mesupa, we're in doubt whether the halacha is like the Ravid or the Rambam. Just a little point of information. You undoubtedly have heard or seen or maybe noticed even that there are some religious Jews that go on the Temple Mount. And in fact, they make a point of it, a pilgrimage, etc. Every month they go to the Temple Mount. Under Israeli law, you are not allowed to daven on the Temple Mount. they will arrest you. If you have a sitter, the police will arrest you. If they see you davening, they will arrest you. Why is that so? Basically, it's a security risk. I mean, this is where the Madrega were at, because the Arabs there watch the Jews like a hawk, and if they see anything that looks like davening, you know, they riot or go crazy or engage in violence. So it's really considered to be a great security risk to daven on the Temple Mount. And the police will move very, very quickly. Just shows you in our own land, on our own Harabias. But this is an interesting place where the consensus of halachic opinion actually says you shouldn't be on the Temple Mount. Don't daven there. So in a way, the more from you is Ein Chinami. You know, don't be there anyway. But let me just explain that. Again, it's mainly a Dati Liumi contingent that goes up there. One of them is a member of my old show, you know. He always tells me, you know, I hate when people say the Kaisel is the holiest place in Yerushalayim. No, there's something holier than the Kaisel. It's what's on the other side of the Kaisel, the Temple Mount itself, even though there are mosques there. But let me just explain the issue here. The issue is this. All of us are tummy today. And that's, nobody can deny that, because if we've ever been to a cemetery, etc., we have Tumas Meis. And Tumas Meis can only be removed with the sprinkling of the ashes of the Parah Aduma. So there's unfortunately no question that all of us are in a permanent and unremovable state of Tuma until we get the Parah Aduma. That's fine. And this is not in Machlokas. Everybody will admit to this. The second point everybody will admit is you're not allowed to enter what is called the camp of the divine presence. Remember, in the desert, we divided the machanos into three levels. The machane shechina was the courtyard of the Mishkan and the Mishkan. Around that was machane leviyah, and around that is machane Yisrael. A tamei mace is allowed to enter, not only the Israelite camp, of course, but even the camp of the Levi, but is not allowed to enter the camp of the Shekhinah. Now, the problem is that the outer part of the Temple Mount is halachically only Machaneh Levi, it's not Machaneh Shekhinah, it's only within a number of feet or number of amos, it's halachically Machaneh Shekhinah. So the Dati Leumi community basically is willing to rely on its own reconstructions, you know, poskim, in which they could identify. So even if you take this trip on the Har HaBayit, you know, they'll instruct you, don't go past that fence. Don't go past. So for example, nobody could go into the Dome of the Rock. Nobody could go there at all. They go on the outer perimeter of the Temple Mount. Now, in principle, Charedim or the Ar Gedolim are 100% agreement. And in other words, it's absolutely clear. If the Beis HaMikdash would be built up, there is no question you would be allowed to go in the outer perimeter of the Temple Mount. The reason we don't is, since archaeologists and historians and poskim are still in disagreement exactly how you lay out the Beis HaMikdash on the Temple Mount, so according to the Rambam, that place still has Kedusha, it's still only according to the Rambam. So as a result, since if you do go into the Makom HaMikdash, you're Chayiv Kares, it's a very severe Aveira, so we don't enter any part of the Temple Mount because we're just not sure. So the Machlokas here is, are you willing to gamble on your certainty, or would you rather not take a chance? So it's not really a machlokas in the halachic principles. It's really a machlokas in the level of confidence you have that this area is not part of the Machaneh Shekhinah and the like. So the Dati Leumi community is not following the Raivad that it doesn't have Kedusha. It's the other way around. It does have Kedusha. And in fact, even in Machaneh Leviah, if a woman, so a Tameh Meis can go into Machaneh Leviah, but a Tameh Meis cannot, I'm sorry, but a person that's a Nida cannot, and a person that had a seminal emission cannot. So the instructions are very clear that women who have not been to the mikveh are not allowed to go, and men that had a seminal emission are not, you know, whether it's through marital intercourse or otherwise, are not allowed to go until they go to the mikveh, and the sun had to set on them. In other words, going to the mikveh is not enough. Going to the mikveh and then a sunset following that. Because that's prohibited even in Machaneh Leviah, and there's no question that the outer perimeter of the Temple Mount is at least Machaneh Leviah. Okay? So it's important to see that there's really not a halachic controversy. Of course it is a halachic controversy, but it's not a halachic controversy in any principle. Everybody agrees on all of the principles. And it's simply a question of, are you willing to stake your life? Because literally, Kares, are you willing to stake your life that this part is not the Machaneh Shekhinah? So the Dati Leumi people are willing to stake their lives. We're a little more cautious. Now, some people are super cautious. Some people say, hey, who says the Temple Mount, you know, begins with the Kotel? Maybe the Kotel is a later additional wall. They actually will not even dive in within a certain number of feet of the Kotel, because maybe the Temple Mount was actually east of the Western Wall. Okay, so there are people that have a Shita, they do not daven in the plaza in front of the Western Wall. And that's besides the Turei Karta. Turei Karta has a different orientation. Turei Karta doesn't do it because they don't recognize the legality of Israel's conquest of the area. If that's a political statement, they will not go, in fact, they won't go to any of the Old City. They will not go into the Old City of Yerushalayim. They will not allow burials in Mount of Olives, because that was Arab property that the Israeli government illegally took. Okay, those are separate. You know, those are separate issues. But there are some people that halachically do not approach the Kotel because they're not sure that that is the original wall, and they're afraid that maybe the wall was built past the outer perimeter of what is the Temple Mount.
Yeah. Someone say like a kind of like a sfek sveka, meaning it's a suffix if it's forbidden to go in the Temple Mount, and it's also a suffix exactly where it's forbidden.
Say again?
First suffix is, are you allowed to go on the Temple Mount?
Oh, because of the Raivad, you mean? Yeah. In other words, okay, so the question is, can we use the Raivad to make a sfek sveka on that? I hear you. I mean, there are, you know, again, I'm not dismissing the halachic grounds for this. I mean, I've heard, you know, eminent rabbis, and again, on the modern side, somewhat, Rabbi Moshe Tendler, who's Rabbi Moshe Feinstein's son-in-law, he, when he's here, he goes, you know, he's listening to Muncie, but he goes to the Temple Mount when he's here, and, you know, he's a very outspoken person. I mean, he basically says that anyone that's machmerin, this is an idiot, you know, type of thing. I mean, I wouldn't, Chas v'Shalom, he can't really say that, but, you know, he considers it a dover pashut, to go, you know, so they're, you know,
how do people figure this out exactly?
Well, they figure it out the following. They figure it out because, I mean, the Mishnah in Midos does tell us how many amos in the Harabayas till you reach the Azara, the courtyard, which would be the beginning of Machaneh Shechem. So they basically, measure it out, and then they calculate, and then they build in something for a margin of error and everything else. They're basically following the Mishnah. I mean, the Mishnah gives you dimensions.
How do they know where it is exactly? It could be here, it could be there.
Yeah, well, that's a big point. Again, that's part of our problem, you know. We have the same Mishnah they do, and we have the same dimensions they do. But we're just not sure, because remember, I mean, there's been so much digging. I mean, the Arabs, whatever, the Muslims have been in control of the place for 1,000 years, and before the Muslims, the Romans, and everything else. And there have been so much digging and excavation, it's very hard to figure out the original configuration of how the Beis HaMikdash was laid out, and where do you start measuring? And, you know, mountains get leveled. Where does the Harabayas begin, right? That's why some people are machmer, even before the Kotel. So, and then, you know, the Mishnah in Midos is contradicted by Josephus in some ways, although we would normally say the Mishnah is more authoritative, but, you know, whatever. So, these are the problems. We just don't want to get in. And also, I think the Rabbanut doesn't say it this way, but the Rabbanut is just afraid that if you tell people they can be in the Temple Mount, but they can't go past a certain area, you know, that's much more difficult. It's much easier to tell a person, the Kaitel is your boundary. That's a big wall. Don't go past this wall. Once you're on the Temple Mount, I mean, there are no walls there. It's just, you know, they have these just little markers, you know, so it's so easy for a person to cross it over. So it just makes sense that you don't tell people. And also, Bichlal, since a woman that's Anita can't go in any part of it, so what are you going to say? A woman wants to go, so you're going to start saying, are you Anita? Do you go to the mikveh? Are you married? You know. So there are a lot of complications. Same with men, with seminal emissions, you know. So it makes sense from a practical perspective, even if halachically, if I am not a Balkari, and, you know, etc., you know, why can't I go? But it actually makes sense just to have a rule, don't go, because there are going to be so many complications. And that's why essentially even the Rabbanut is not particularly machmerin, like the Rabbanut is generally very, very makel. But the Rabbanut consistently issues a proclamation that it is forbidden for Jews. They don't stop people. In other words, the Rabbanut doesn't have legal authority to stop people. But the Rabbanut always announces that you're not allowed to go on the, I mean, Kal B'Chomer, the Bedatz, and everybody else, but even the Rabbanut always says you're not allowed to go on the Temple Mount. But again, there are Dati Liumi Poskim, you know, who are knowledgeable people who do permit it with all of these conditions. Okay, yeah.
Is it generally agreed upon by everyone that the sort of few feet within the Temple Mount was probably not where the Holy of Holies was?
Yes.
I mean, it sounds like they weren't sure where it was, but are they sure where it was not?
Well, yes, but let me just explain one thing. Since the Holy of Holies is located in the western extremity of the temple, so the part of the Harabayit that is closest to the Kotel, in some place, is where the Kodesh HaKodashim is. Now, if you would enter the Beis HaMikdash from the Nachal Kidron, the Kidron Valley, mm-hmm. You know, that's where the Mount of Olives is, that valley. Then, for sure, you would know that you're not bumping into the Kodesh HaKodashim, because that's the edge. Now, this thing, again, something interesting. Think about this. You know, we don't visualize this way. The main entrance of the Beis HaMikdash was in the back of the Kotel. It was from the other side. That was the eastern gate. The Beis HaMikdash is entered from east to west. So imagine you're entering it from the Nachal Kidron, and you're going in. The Kotel, actually the Kotel is the Temple Mount wall, but it's the back wall of the Temple Mount You see? So it's precisely that area that's right over the Kotel that in which the Kodesh HaKadoshim right? So yeah. So we could identify certainly the areas directly west of the what's called the Golden Gate. The Golden Gate is that part of the wall on the other side was built by the Muslims. It wasn't built by Jews. That wall, and if you remember, that has a gate that's sealed, etc. But in the time of the Beis Hamikdash, that was the main gate to the Beis Hamikdash. That was, not that gate, but that is where you had the gates of Niknor. The gates of Niknor, that was the gate of the courtyard of the Beis Hamikdash. Again, it's a little confusing because that's not where people entered from the outside. In other words, people entered the Temple Mount. They entered the Temple Mount from the south. And you can still see that's where they have the southern wall excavations. Mm-hmm. That's where they entered the Temple Mount from the south. But then if you were entering the Mikdash, the Heichal proper, you would then go around to the east and go in. But the main entrance was to the south, which is called Chulda's Gate. Chulda, the female prophet, used to sit there and give prophecies and
which gate was that? Teaching. Which gate was Chulda?
Chulda is the gate of the south. The southern gate of the Harabayas is Chulda's Gate. Okay, so people didn't enter the Mikdash from the east, but they entered the Temple Mount and then they turned towards the east side. Yep.
So the western wall is a problem, but yes. Because the Kodesh HaKadosh probably bordered on it.
Right.
But was it likely not in the southwest corner? Like if you're on the western wall,
no,
just inside at the southern corner.
No, that's very true. It certainly was not at the corner. But again, let me remind you. Although obviously walking into the Kodesh HaKadosh is worse than anything any other part of the temple. But remember, the principle that a Tameh person cannot walk into the Machane Shechina isn't only referring to the Kodesh HaKadosh, anything that's considered to be the temple courtyards. So whether it's Kodesh HaKadosh or not, if it's Machane Shechina, I would be Chayav Kores for entering. So even if you know it's not the Kodesh HaKadosh, that's not going to help you automatically. Yeah.
Somebody went up on the Temple Mount and Penchlula, putting aside the fact that Israeli authorities would arrest him. Would he be Yossi ben Daraisa? All 7 days.
Okay, so that's a very very interesting question. And the question is, well, first of all, I guess there's a lot of things to keep in mind. You guys all learned this Mishnah, right? The Mishnah says in Maseches Sukkah that the Daraisa lulav b'mikdash is 7 days, and outside of Mikdash it's only first day. All the other days are drabanan. Zecher l'mikdash. Now, first of all, remember this. There is a machlekes Rashi in the Rambam. What do we mean by mikdash? Rashi says only in the Beis HaMikdash, but the Rambam says Yerushalayim is the Makam HaMikdash. Now, Yerushalayim doesn't mean here. Yerushalayim means the part of Yerushalayim that has the wall around it, the old city. So according to this is the Rambam Shita. According to the Rambam Shita, the mitzvah d'Iraisa is anywhere in the old city. It doesn't have to be on the Temple Mount. So there are many people who do make it a point. They go to the Kotel because it's a Kotel, but what's really going on is they want to be in the old city to bench lulav to fulfill the mitzvah d'Iraisa according to the Rambam. Now, according to Rashi, that's not going to be enough, because according to Rashi, you have to be on the site of the Beis HaMikdash itself. So being in front of the Kaisel, I'm still not on the Harabayas. According to Rashi, you'd have to be in the Machane Shechina. You'd have to be in the exact area that you're not allowed to go. So if I went on the outer perimeter, according to Rashi, it could be I would not be Yetzei Daraisa. I'd have to go into the inner perimeter, and then you'd have a shayla of mitzvah babi avera, because I'm doing mitzvah by committing the sin of going into that area when I'm tummy. You see? So I would therefore surmise that according to Rashi, it would not be possible today to fulfill the mitzvah of the Arisa. According to the Rambam, it is, because I can go to the Kotel or anywhere in the old city, really, and fulfill that mitzvah. So it would be totally in that machlokas. According to the Ravid, it would also be impossible, because since the Ravid says the Kedusha has lapsed after the Churban, so it doesn't have the status of a Makam Kadosh for purposes of those Nesses. But Rabbi Yashav used to, Rabbi Yashav made a point when he was well that he would go close to the Kotel to bench Lulav every day to at least fulfill it according to the Rambam. And in fact, have you ever been to Isha Torah's hotel, the five-star...
Isha Torah's
a beautiful...
their balcony?
Not just a balcony, but the whole structure. They even have a full-time concierge. I was at a chasna there, and there was a guy whose job it is like to show you around, you know, show you the place, show you the view. But they showed me an interesting thing. You know, there's the view on top, but they have a very, very interesting basement thing where they take you to a basement that opens up directly like 10 feet from the kotel.
Yeah.
You know, and like really deluxe. They have VIP, like VIPs could even, you know, if you're really a rich guy, like you can drive your car like it's like a Batcave. You can drive your car like under, and you know, you get free parking, and then you just walk, you know, 5 feet, 10 feet to the kotel.
Where does it come out?
I don't remember. Where does it come out? It comes out like, well, it's not that close, but it comes out like, it comes out right at the beginning of the plaza, so you have to walk through the plaza. But you know, you're able to park right there. And then you just walk out, you know, from just through the plaza. So they told me that they did this, Rebbe Yashav used to come. They would drive Rebbe Yashav there, and then he would be able to bench Lulav and Esrog right at the kotel. But Rebbe Yashav, again, he didn't have to bench right next to the kotel. He says he would sometimes bench just from there. In other words, he just wanted to be sure he was in an area that was the old city of Yerushalayim, and then he felt he was Yotzei, the Mitzvah. There was, by the way, I don't know if you heard that, Rebbe Yashav's oldest son was Nifter just yesterday. Rebbe Avram, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, obviously he was overshadowed by his father, but he was a great, great Talmud Chacham and a great Anuf and a great great Tzadik. Only 71 years old, he was not so old.
That was his oldest son?
I think it may. It's not his oldest child because Rebbe Kanievsky was older. She was the oldest child. But I throw Rebbe's the oldest son. I'm not sure. I'll check it. Because Rebbe Yashav got married a little later than normal. I think he was like 28 or something when he got married.
It's probably learning.
He was learning. It was interesting. He didn't want to get married because he had absolutely no parnasa whatsoever.
Oh. Well.
And he said he always could not support a family. Rav Aryeh Levin, the great tzaddik of Yerushalayim, wanted Rebbe Yashav as a son-in-law. So he went to Rav Kook, and he asked Rav Kook to convince Rebbe Yashav to get married. So Rav Kook, you know, convinced Rebbe Yashav to get married, and Rav Kook was the Masada Kedushin. Again, it's a different world, you know. Now in the Haredi world, you know, people in Mazalzol Rav Kook, and they say this and that. And Rav Kook was, he was Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach's Rebbe, Rebbe Yashav's Rebbe. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was different. People didn't... Rav Kook had detractors even then. I'm not suggesting his life was easy. There were kanoim that you know, said all sorts of bad things about him. But certainly there were great, great gedolim that were very, very close to him, and they admired him, and they were machshavim tremendously as their Rebbe. Mm-hmm. Rebbe Yashav was an example, or Shlomo Zalman was another example. But that's what Eishet Torah has, kind of that little... underground garage to the Kotel.
How do we define the walls of the old city, like the border of the old city? Because the current walls are Turkish, right?
No, you're 100% correct. This is a common misconception people have. We do talk about the walled city as having holiness, but these particular walls mean nothing because they were built by Suleiman the Magnificent in the 1500s. And they do not, in and of themselves, they confer no kedusha whatsoever. However, it happens to be that to a large extent it tracks what was the old city in the time of the Beis HaMikdash, but not completely. For example, Mount Zion, Har Zion, was clearly within the boundaries of the old city, but in Suleiman's wall, it's outside.
Hmm. Where is that?
That's where... you know where they ask for yeshiva is? If you just walk around, in other words, I'm trying to get my sense of directions. When you're facing Har HaZeisim, you're facing east, right? So if you walk, if you walk, one second, east, west. Yeah, if you walk south, right, you're facing walk south, so you will encounter a yeshiva and a little community. That's Har Tzion.
Outside of the wall.
Is that the city of David?
It's right in the
city of David.
Like the tunnels?
That's correct. It's outside. Now, that is part of Kedusha Shushim. That is the old city of Yerushalayim. But it's outside of the wall. Now, this was actually a goof. If you walk inside Shar Yafa, I'm told it's there, but I looked. I couldn't find it. They say inside Shar Yafa, there are the graves of two Muslims. Two Muslims are buried in Shar Yafa. And these are ancient graves. Not ancient, these are graves from the 1500s. And apparently, these were the builders or the architects of the old city wall. And when Suleiman the Magnificent discovered that they neglected to include Har Tzion, even though that was King David's Jerusalem, so he did two things. He had them executed, but then he had a nice memorial put up, you know, recognizing and appreciating all the hard work that they did. So they were honored posthumously as, you know, the builders of the wall, but he was quite annoyed, so he actually killed them. So you're 100% correct. The wall as we have it is meaningless, except for the fact that it more or less mirrors the wall that the Sanhedrin built around the city.
Is Tzion referred to as a mountain?
Har Tzion, well, you know, the term Har Tzion, which is a very, very common phrase, sometimes Tzion is for all of Yerushalayim, right? That's where you get the word Zionism. But Har Tzion is also a separate mountain. It's called Mount Zion. There is a mountain called, but again, a mountain in Israel is not like Mount Everest. You know, the highest mountain in Yerushalayim is Har HaTzofim, Mount Scopus. In fact, it's called Scopus. Scopus, Sofim in Hebrew is to look, because when you were coming from the north, the first time you would see Yerushalayim is from the top of Har HaTzofim. The famous pictures of the Kotel are all from, or not the Kotel, the Dome of the Rock are all from Har HaTzofim. But Har HaTzofim is the highest mountain in Yerushalayim. How high is it? It's 800 meters. 800 meters is a hill, you know. We don't really have mountains.
Above sea level?
Huh?
Above sea level?
Above sea levels, yeah. Yeah, so that's no big deal, really. I mean, you get walks, you get out of breath, but I mean, it's not, if you're a mountain climber, that's not any particular challenge you're going to look at. Now, we have Mount Hermon, we have mountains up north a little more. So Har Tzion is much less than that. So really, it's a hill. I mean, Shalim is built on a bunch of little hills. I wish they would be leveled a little bit more, but whatever, we have these little hills. So Har Tzion is one of the hills. One of the hills of Yerushalayim is Har Tzion. And in David HaMelech's time, it was inside the wall. And this guy, whoever did it, these two guys forgot to include it. And unfortunately, they were punished quite severely. But you're 100% correct. The Kedusha of the old city is a function of what was that city, not what this guy built inside the wall, or not inside the wall. So when we talk about the walled city, it's really it's a shorthand term, but it's not fully accurate. Okay, make sure you guys have a good Shabbos, and you be well.
Amen. Thanks so much, Shabbos.